Hi, and welcome to DC Public Safety. I'm your host, Len Sipes. Today's guest is Matt Kiley. Matt is a supervisor with my agency, the Court Services and Offender Supervision Agency. He deals with sex offenders, and I think we're going to talk about a very interesting topic today. We're going to talk about polygraph test for sex offenders. And most people are not going to understand what a polygraph test is. It's basically a lie detector test. We use lie detector tests for sex offenders to be sure, as one tool, not to be sure, as a tool to increase our level of supervision and increase the level of truthfulness, and if I understand this correctly, to really help the offender confront his own reality and to help in terms of his own treatment process. And with that long introduction, Matt Kiley, hi, how you doing?
Len, good morning. How you doing?
I'm fine. Now, did I get it right, Matt, in terms of my description, or did I screw it up?
Correct. It's an investigative tool, which we use in part to design the treatment plan of the offender. So it's not trying to catch the offender in a lie, but more so trying to obtain information to deal with his sex offender treatment plan and sex offender treatment contract.
But a lot of sex offenders, and let me state this for the audience, because they're going to ask, why are you supervising them out in the community? These are individuals either coming out of the prison system, the federal prison system, and they're now under mandatory supervision, or they're under parole, and they are ours to supervise at the end of their sentence. So say the person says has a 10-year sentence and he serves 70% of it. Well, the 3 years left of his sentence, he is accountable to us. If he gets the term of probation, which means he's under our supervision but didn't go to prison, at least this time, he's still under our supervision for whatever amount of years the judge gave him. So we get a certain amount of sex offenders. How many sex offenders do we currently supervise? It's within the hundreds, right?
Right. 600? Currently in my unit, we have about 198 total. That includes active, monitored, and some warrant cases. There's two other units, so roughly about 400, I believe.
Total
sex offenders that we supervise. There's well more than that on the registry, which is a separate issue.
Right, and at the sex offender registry and here in the District of Columbia, and that is indeed a separate issue. But we did, Matt, an entirely different show.
Correct.
On the sex offender registry. We had the Metropolitan Police Department and our own people in to talk about the sex offender registry. So here we're talking about the supervision and treatment of sex offenders, but sex offenders are, in essence, a lot of them are pretty much in denial, correct?
Correct. Some offenders have been denying the crime for years. I mean, you're talking about some offenders who have been locked up 15, 20 years, come out, and they reach a point where they actually believe that they did not commit the crime.
Well, and also at the same time, whatever crime they committed was justified within their own mind in the context of she was my girlfriend, or this was a consensual relationship, or this was in her best interest, or I was just simply trying to be her friend. But the hard, cold reality that this is obviously an illegal act against, generally speaking, women, in a lot of cases, minor children, that, you know, you've got to sometimes pounded into their heads of, look, buddy, you committed a crime. In fact, you've committed a series of crimes. And if you continue committing those crimes, we're going to put you back in prison. I mean, that's the hard, cold reality in terms of getting through that denial, correct?
Right. It's a long process. Certainly isn't overnight. And similar to drug treatment, most treatment providers agree that treatment cannot be successful until the offender breaks his or her denial.
And that becomes a good segue into a lot of different arenas, because when we talk about community supervision, I did a radio show years ago and somebody said, you know, the first time the person screws up, put them back in prison. And my response was, you'd have to put everybody back in prison, because these aren't Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts in many cases. They come out with immense problems, mental health problems, substance abuse problems, domestic violence problems, and in this case, sex offender problems. And in some cases, it is the process of relapse in terms of all of these issues, whether it be domestic violence, whether it be mental health, whether it be drug treatment, or whether it be sex offender treatment, is part of our day-to-day reality, correct?
Correct. It's almost inherent in the system. There's going to be failures, but it's what you do when they do fail. kind of dictates where you go from there.
Right. Now, if there are sufficient failures, needless to say, if we catch a child sex offender stalking another child or engaged in the process of trying to entice that person, we'll put the person back in prison. I don't think there's any doubt about that. But there's all sorts of other levels in mm-hmm. between that we have to deal with. And we just cannot send every human being back to prison. The prisons would explode tomorrow. We would overload the prisons instantaneously. Within a month, we would overload the prison system. So we have to maintain these individuals in the community and protect public safety, and at the same time to give him or her an opportunity to, whether it be a substance abusing offender, domestic violence, it doesn't matter, mental health, we have to give them some opportunities to correct bad behavior.
Correct. And based on the levels of severity, we apply graduated sanctions. Like you said, an offender along with a minor who has an offense history against minors, who may be in violation of no contact with minors.
Right.
We find that we have requested warrants. We have had warrants issued and quickly executed. So we deal with the severity
of sanctions.
So public
safety becomes first. I mean, is our first objective, correct. Needless to say. But dealing with sex offenders, we're talking about an extraordinarily complex world, because we started off the conversation that they make these endless rationalizations in their mm-hmm. own minds in terms of their behavior. And getting beyond those rationalizations and getting to the point where we know what he did in the past and we know how he is now is an essential ingredient, not only in terms of his supervision, but in terms of the treatment process.
Right. You need to confront the offender with that. And we need to get to the point that we all agree that the offender takes responsibility for what he did. Not that he had sex with a 15, 16-year-old, that he actually caused the harm in having sex with her. Because as you know, some offenders will cognitively distort their crimes, their violations, indicate I caused no harm.
Okay.
You know.
Yeah, understood. Now, Matt, before we go into this whole issue of polygraphy or a polygraph test or a lie detector test, mm-hmm. and we understand from the conversation that we had at the beginning of the program is that they're not really lie detector tests, and we have to explain that to the audience. How did you get involved in, number one, community supervision? Most people throughout the country that do this sort of job are called parole and probation agents. We call our folks community supervision officers. You're a supervisory community supervision officer.
Right.
You have a team of people who you supervise, but how did you get involved in this business?
I did my undergraduate work at a small school in Western Maryland. Then right afterwards, went into grad school up at University of Baltimore. I was lucky enough to catch this agency in its infancy when in 98 mm-hmm. was part of the first CSO class.
Right. It's a brand new agency that most people don't understand that. We're a brand new federal agency.
Right. So in 1998 was the first CSO class, was a CSO in general supervision for 4 years.
Okay.
Was promoted in 2002. Initially was assigned to the diagnostic unit doing a pre-sentence report on mm-hmm. offenders, supervised a team over there. And then I think it was in 2003 when they created a third, due to the numbers, a third sex offender unit that I took over the sex offender unit.
How did you, by the way, I graduated as well from the University of Baltimore.
Good school.
It is a good school. It's a wonderful school, wonderful experience, one of the best collegiate experiences I had. Okay, so you got involved in the sex offender unit. Why? Tough, crazy unit to be in.
Right. Well, I was asked. The associate director was creating a third unit, was asked if I was interested in leading that. I knew it would be an experience something that I really wanted to eventually get into. I dealt with the general supervision offender, dealt with diagnostics, and I wanted something more, somewhat of a tougher challenge, if you will.
And it's interesting because we have a high-risk drug offender unit. We have the mental health unit, and we have the sex offender unit, and these are fairly small caseloads, generally speaking, and it's always interesting that everybody wants to be in these units because they want the challenge, and mm-hmm. my heavens, in terms of high-risk drug offenders, people who have had a long history of drugs and substance abuse, the mental health folks, the sex mm-hmm. offender folks, there are people within the criminal justice system throughout my years in the system that just gravitate towards the hardest possible jobs. Mm-hmm. I've had wonderful conversations with police officers here in the District of Columbia as well as Baltimore City who patrol the highest crime neighborhoods because that's that's where it's really interesting. Right. That's where the challenge really is. And so you take on willingly this this extraordinarily difficult group of offenders to supervise.
Right. And you deal with all types of offenders in the sex offender unit.
Explain that, all types of offenders.
Well, basically, we want to cast a wide net and making sure that we're supervising every type of sexual offender out there. So, for instance, if an offender has a previous rape conviction, does his jail time, gets off supervision, and then 10 years down the road gets convicted of drug dealing, he gets assigned to our agency for supervision.
Really?
That offender will be supervised by the sex offender unit.
Interesting.
Time... we want to have him assessed to see if he needs sex offender treatment.
Okay.
See if conditions are modified. So we not only supervise those offenders who are currently on supervision for a sex offense, but if they have a past sex offense
in the past.
In the past, we also will do that.
When we're talking about sex offenders, are we, and again, I apologize for asking you this. I didn't tell you beforehand I would be asking you these sort of statistical questions. Mm-hmm. But in terms of what we call sex offenders, is our universe mostly of individuals who commit predatory attacks on adults? Or are we talking about principally people who are involved with children or those under the age of 18?
Probably say half and half.
Half and half.
What's more concerning, once they get involved in treatment, you get those unreported crimes that no one ever knew about. He's
right.
Before us for a rape of an adult, but you right. find out that he has 3 or 4 instances where he has had sexual contact with a minor.
Well, and that's the controversy involved in all of this because, you know, years ago when I left the Maryland State Police and went to college, one of the things that we were taught is that it's all interconnected in one way, shape, or form. I don't know what the state of the art is now, but even pedophiles, so mm-hmm. the people who are just... I'm sorry, not pedophiles. What am I talking about? The people who look in windows, the peeping toms,
right.
and the people who are exhibitionists, who expose themselves to other people. That you take a look at a rapist and you take a look at a child sex offender, and once you get into their psyches, you find an array of behavior that touches, in many cases, all of these things. Mm-hmm. Is that true, or is there a way of stating that definitively, or is that still in flux?
Well, you're dealing with different types of offenders in our unit. You're dealing with, as you mentioned, the pedophile, who is probably the highest risk offender that we supervise.
Right.
Those offenders who have victims...
Well, it doesn't strike me that the pedophiles may be involved in adult rape because his sexual disposition is towards children.
Correct. And that's what he focuses on. Then we have the offenders who are rapists, and that's all they have ever done is raped adults unknown to them. As you mentioned before, we have the exhibitionists that basically the mentality, they're also at a high level to reoffend. It's a behavior that we see repeatedly. It's just not one exposure. It's multiple times, multiple places.
Well, and not to get too graphic about this, the sense here is that if you have a sexual predisposition, mm-hmm. and to me, it doesn't really matter what that sexual predisposition is, but if you have that predisposition, I'm assuming it's sort of like heterosexual predisposition. You know, I don't think you're going to change your heterosexual predisposition. If you are predisposed towards children, mm-hmm. I would imagine that's pretty much a lifelong issue.
If for some offenders, yes. And that's what we hope in the course of treatment, that by focusing on cognitive behavioral controls, i.e. where we're trying to modify their behavior, modify mm-hmm. their thoughts, mm-hmm. Offenders recognize when they may be in a lapse. So they avoid reoffending by recognizing their own cycle of abuse, in a sense.
Okay. But they recognize their own cycle of abuse from the standpoint that they really understand that it's wrong and they're not going to do it again, or they simply know how to control it?
I think it varies. Some offenders realize it's wrong through the course of many months and particularly many years of treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And I think other offenders are just along for the ride.
Okay.
I have no intention of changing.
Which brings us right back to the topic of the program in terms of polygraphy / polygraph test / lie detector test.
Right.
Now, lie detector test is not, that's even though I titled the program lie detector test for sex offenders, you explained to me at the beginning of the program that there's, that's really a misnomer, that you're really, it's not so much a lie detector test.
Right.
And that's the difficulty in terms of explaining this. But if I call the program polygraphy for sex offenders, nobody's going to understand what we're talking about.
No one's going to click on that.
So I called it lie detector test for sex offenders. What is the reality of the, or of these tests?
All right. Well, basically, as I noted earlier, is it detects changes in one's body. You're not dealing with detection of lies, but you're dealing with detection of indications of
When I took lie detector test. When I was joining the police department, I took two, one as a cadet and one before entering as a trooper. It was explained to me that you simply measure certain, I forget the word that they said, but physical responses to your questions. So in other words, if I'm there and I've got these diodes or whatever the heck they are around my body, and if my body gives off these impulses when you say, Mr. Sipes, have you ever committed a felony?
Right.
Well, then obviously I just had this huge reaction to that question. So that leads the investigator to ask additional questions. Is that basically what we're talking about?
Correct. Your body's going to react to something that you know is incorrect. Similar story that in researching this matter, you're walking down the hall, having idle conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Someone reaches around the corner and fires a gun. Your body's automatically going to react.
Right. Your body's going to react. But lie detector tests are not used as admissible evidence in court, correct? That is something that is a finding throughout the country, or do I have that right or wrong?
It's actually incorrect. It is used in some jurisdictions.
Really?
Both sides have to agree to it, and both sides have to agree on the scientific reliability of it.
Wow. Okay, but we do know that there are a lot of false positives regarding lie detector tests. To some degree?
To some degree, certainly, why it's not on a wide scale approved in every courtroom in this country. Correct.
Right. And that's simply because if somebody is polygraphing me and they're basically saying, Mr. Sipes, have you ever broken the law? Everybody has broken the law at some point, either by speeding or, you know, when you were 13 years old, you took a candy bar or whatever.
Right.
You know, none of us lives perfectly clean lives. So I could have a response to that, a physiological response. That's the word I was looking for. I could have a physiological response where I would jerk and move and my eyes would get big or whatever, because I'm worried as to how to truthfully answer this question. That doesn't necessarily mean I'm lying. It simply means that I have a strong physiological or physical reaction to that question.
Right. And one of the important parts of the polygraph is the pretest. During the pretest, the polygrapher we'll go over an array of questions with the offender. They could deal with supervision conditions, could deal with your sexual history, or could specifically deal with, as they call it, the instant offense, could deal with the offensive record, what the offender was convicted of.
And there, what we're asking are very straightforward questions. What is the time of day? Is your name John Doe? Were you convicted for this offense? These are pretty much yes or no questions, correct?
Correct.
And you set up that baseline.
Correct.
And from that, you can judge whether or not there's a strong physiological reaction to the questions that we ask.
Right. It will tell us in what areas if the offender is being deceptive. And generally, the contractors we use will run these reports, will forward the reports to us, whether deception was indicated or deception was not indicated.
Okay.
In instances where deception is indicated, the polygrapher will confront the offender after the polygraph and say, question number one, question number two, show signs of deception. Do you have anything to say?
Right. And is he still hooked up?
No. At that point, it's basically a post-test interview.
Okay.
The quote-unquote, the polygraph is done.
Okay.
You know, it's over.
All right.
With deception indicated or no deception indicated, or in some cases, inconclusive, where the polygrapher could not get a good judge on the reading, which happens sometimes. But at that point, the offender gets a chance to respond. For instance, if the polygrapher said there was deception regarding the number of minors, the polygrapher will kind of dig a little deeper as far as, are you sure there were only two in your history versus three or four?
Right.
And in many instances, the offender will admit additional victims, which basically validates the polygraph test, indicating that's the reason why the deception indicated, because it wasn't two, it turned out to be five or six.
So, Matt, how many different kinds of polygraph tests are we talking about?
When we usually have three. We have the instant offense history, which is, addresses the offense of conviction in conjunction with the official version. We have the sexual history, which looks at the entire sex offending behavior of the offender. And then we have the maintenance or monitoring polygraph, which is given to those offenders already on supervision and during the course of supervision, to review issues concerning compliance with treatment, compliance with supervision, and may adjust supervision controls on the offender should new information come to light.
It's a lot of polygraph tests.
Correct.
Can somebody beat the polygraph test? Now, that's the question inevitably that somebody is going to be asking themselves as they're listening to this program. They're going to say, I can beat that polygraph test, or I've heard of people beating the polygraph test.
Right.
Can a person beat a polygraph test?
I guess anybody can do anything they see fit. We did have one offender that discussed his concerns about the polygraph in the pretest, admitted that he purchased a book on how to defeat the polygraph. And again, that showed his intent was to try to defeat the polygraph. Whether he could or could not, it's a different issue. But
somebody told me, and this is, I think, the advantage that we have in terms of a parole and probation organization, is that it's not a one-shot deal. We polygraph, as you just said, we polygraph these individuals in a variety of different ways. We put them on GPS monitoring, which is satellite monitoring. We, in some cases, will have people follow them after hours, at night, that sort of thing. We work with local law enforcement. They're in a treatment process. We use a, I can never say it correctly, a pismograph, okay,
PPG,
which is designed to focus on the offender's arousal mechanisms when he sees certain stimuli. So there's a whole mess of things that is basically going to tell us whether or not this person is telling the truth and whether or not this person is being honest with us. We don't rely upon one particular thing. We rely upon a totality of technology to figure out whether or not this person's a straight shooter. Am I right?
Yes. Like you said, we rely on a whole bunch of things, the offender's autobiographies, you know, investigative interviewing, contact with family, in conjunction with GPS surveillance.
And in conjunction with his own criminal history.
Right.
So we have a pretty daggone good idea as to who this sex offender is, who this person is as a human being, through polygraph tests, through lie detector tests, and through all the other technology that we employ, because he could lie to us all that he wants. But if he's hanging out at a school after work, that GPS device is going to tell us that he's there, and we go back and we find out why he's there. We can also go in and take a look at his hard drive on his computer, correct? And we can do that remotely. We can do that from our own offices. So that's another piece of technology. But I think there was an example one time of an offender who went to a local library, and we come to find out that that's where he was trying to log on to sexual related databases. So there's a wide variety of tools at our disposal to figure out, you know, whether or not this person's a straight shooter, whether or not this person is trying to do the right thing, or whether or not he's just another criminal trying to reoffend.
Right. And that offender, Len, years later, gets released, comes back out in the community, this time has additional special conditions placed on his certificate, one of which he could not access the internet. We questioned him in conjunction with GPS. The CSO questioned him about his location in Maryland. The offender admitted he was visiting an uncle. The CSO followed up, spoke with the uncle, spoke with the niece. They had a computer, found out it had internet access. They basically both stated that the offender was on the computer.
Right.
We brought our IT department up there. Could not find any internet access activity, but we did find a letter in which the offender was writing an inmate, which is another violation of his conditions, which clearly stated that he was about to give up. He was tired of the GPS tag on his ankle or so forth. And eventually, that evidence, in conjunction with everything else, supported revocation, which the offender was sentenced to 2 more years in the institution.
Good. Good for us. Anything else that I've forgotten? Because part of this whole discussion has been on sex offenders generically. Part of it has been on the lie detector process. So I guess I should ask, am I missing anything regarding lie detectors or the larger issue of supervising sex offenders?
No, we kind of covered it. It is probably one of the best tools we have. And I can show you in another quick example where an offender who had completed treatment, he had gone through 2+ years. He was a pedophile, so he was extremely high risk, but he had gone through the whole treatment. And part of treatment aftercare is maintenance polygraphs every 6 months.
Oh, really?
So he's referred back to treatment.
We don't give up, do we?
No. We continue to work with him because we realize this is, with some offenders, it's a cycle.
It's a sexual predisposition.
Right. And the offender was referred back to the treatment provider for a few meetings with the psychologist to go over a pre-polygraph interview. And when questioned if he would be able to pass the polygraph, the offender hesitated and said, I don't know. And this is an offender who had previously passed his two previous polygraphs, which is a big sign of a problem. He engaged the offender in conversation, and we learned through the psychologist later on that basically the offender had communicated with a 17, 18-year-old on the internet. That was that Thursday. That Monday, we conducted a search at the offender's apartment. Found 150 individual MySpace page photos, pornography. Found a photo of the offender in New York City, which is a violation of his conditions. We wrote the violation report on a Wednesday. The commission issued a warrant on Thursday. The offender came into the office on a Friday for his regular visit, and the warrant was executed.
So I guess the lesson is that you can fool us every once in a while, but you're not going to be able to fool us consistently.
Certainly.
Okay. Matt Kiley, Supervisory Community Supervision Officer with the Court Services and Offender Supervision Agency. Thank you. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening to DC Public Safety. Look at our website, if you will, www.csosa.gov, www.csosa.gov. For TV shows, other radio shows, and articles about our sex offender unit, please have yourselves a very pleasant day.